This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, broadcasting today from the Grosvenor Auditorium at the National Geographic Society. This is a wonderful building filled with artifacts and pictures brought back by famous explorers from the Amazon, the poles, the top of the world, and the ocean depths. But in the 21st century, what's left to explore? You can not only pinpoint the position of your house in a few seconds on a smartphone, you can call up a picture. Satellites can track minute changes on coastlines, even estimate the contours of the ocean floor. What do explorers do in the 21st century? We're going to limit the conversation today to planet Earth, if you will. So we want to hear from scientists and researchers today, geologists, physicists, anthropologists, what's left to explore. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We'll also get questions from here in the audience at the Grosvenor Auditorium. We begin with a geologist and underwater explorer, maybe best known for the discovery of the wreck of the Titanic, but who's also found lost ships that date to ancient Phoenicia and helped discover new forms of life on the floor of the Pacific. Robert Ballard is president of the Institute for Exploration in Mystic, Connecticut, and an explorer in residence here at National Geographic. And Robert Ballard, thanks very much for being with us today.
Nice to be back.
What's left to explore in 2011?
Lots. When you think about the fact that we only live on less than 20%. 28% is above the ocean, but there's a lot of that we don't live on. So when you really think about it, we're living on the peaks of mountains and don't know what's down in the valleys. So, I think the age of exploration is just beginning, not ending, on our planet. In fact, the next generation of kids, many of which are here today, think about it, we'll probably explore more of Earth than all previous generations combined.
Well, how do you say that? We've been to all the jungles and the ocean and the mountaintops that we could see anyway.
Yeah, but most of the ocean's underwater, and most of that is in eternal darkness. We've seen very little of it. We actually have better maps of Mars than our own planet. And in fact, half of the United States of America lies beneath the sea, and we've yet to do the Lewis and Clark, I should modify that, the Lois and Clark expeditions of that territory that's our own country, unexplored.
Yet I've been on ships with you looking at the ocean floor 17,000 feet below. There's not a lot there.
Oh, there's a lot. The greatest mountain ranges on Earth. You just weren't looking. Yeah, you got to turn on the lights, Neil. But the greatest mountain ranges on the planet lie beneath the sea. There are more active volcanoes, tens of thousands of active volcanoes that have never been explored, never been seen by human beings. And as you mentioned, my discoveries, the hydrothermal vents, for example, I would think was my greatest discovery. We knew where Titanic was, but we never knew about these new life forms. And we didn't know they were there. We stumbled over them. And so how many other things are there down there to stumble over? I vote lots.
Robert Ballard is with us, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And that's your specialty, underwater exploration.
Well, I'm an earth scientist. I love all of the earth. I think of it as a living organism. So I don't separate the oceans from the planets. It's just that most of it's down there. But I do spend a lot of time above water, and spent a lot of time exploring that part of our Earth that lies above the sea. But statistically, most of it's down there, so I'm going to spend most of my time down there.
And how does technology change your ability to find it? Obviously, we've only been able to explore anywhere beyond a few feet below the water in the past few decades.
Well, that's changing. The new telepresent technology. I published 29 years ago a cartoon in National Geographic magazine talking about the day will come when we don't send our bodies, we send our spirits through telepresent technology. That technology is now here, and we are going to see a rapid acceleration of exploration. I think we're going to not be saying the same thing in 20 years. We will have seen a lot more in the next 20 years than we've seen through the history of the human race. So I'm very optimistic about what we're going to find. I think we're going to find a lot of cool things. I just can't tell you what they are.
You've told us a story of going down in the submarine, the famous submersible Alvin,
right,
to the ocean depths, a trip that takes hours and hours and hours and carries some measure of risk, and there's a lot of preparation involved. Being there on the ocean floor, looking at those thermal vents with biologists, and realizing they weren't looking out the window.
That was funny. That was sort of funny because when we discovered the hydrothermal vents in 1977, there weren't any biologists on the expedition. It took 2 years to actually organize an expedition. It would take us about a nanosecond now. But it took us 2 years to get back, and we brought Holger Janisch, a very famous microbiologist at Woods Hole, was my dive mate. We got down there, and I'd seen the hydrothermal vents, so I took him over to him and said, "There they are." And he looked out the window, and I had brought with me the first digital camera ever built. And I had it on the manipulator. I had to turn my back to the windows to operate it. And so I'm looking at this little TV monitor, and all of a sudden, Holger's looking over my shoulder. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm looking at the monitor. It's better than what I'm seeing out the window." And I said, "Then why are you here?" And that's what led to the development of telepresence technology. You don't have to bring the body. The body is sort of a pain. It has to go to the bathroom. It has to be comfortable. But the spirit is indestructible. It can move at the speed of light. So this new technology is literally out-of-body experiences, sort of avatar in the modern age, you know.
And then there was a long period when you had to be on the
surface,
above the robots you were sending to the ocean floor.
It takes time. But now we have this amazing high-bandwidth satellite link at the Graduate School of Oceanography at University of Rhode Island, where I'm a professor. We have the Inner Space Center. And if you go into the Inner Space Center, we literally move the command control center to there. But now on Internet 2, you can be anywhere. You can have it on your iPhone, your laptop, any kind of media. We can take you to the bottom of the ocean, and we have what's called the Doctors on Call program. We call in experts when we need them and move their spirits out of their bodies and take them to the bottom of the ocean. And that's very, very green, I think, is the discussion you had earlier about global population. Key is don't have bodies moving all over the place. Just move spirits.
Here's an email we have from Keith in Houston, Texas. "I work as an oil exploration geologist. We work with data obtained from wells and geophysical methods to try to understand what's under the ground. The current limits onshore are only about 30,000 feet. We have barely scratched the subsurface."
Correct. I mean, there's an amazing amount of oil and gas and other resources out beneath the sea. It's staggering. This last maiden voyage of the Nautilus, which we just finished, 5 months at sea, I found more gas pouring out of the bottom of the ocean naturally than you can imagine. I mean, everywhere I went, methane was coming out of the bottom of the ocean, and this was natural, and I wonder if that's in anyone's calculations.
Let's see if we go to a caller. This is Cliff. Cliff with us from Jacksonville in Arkansas. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Thanks for putting me on.
Go ahead, please.
I read in the introduction to the novel Relic, which the guys that wrote it did a lot of research. They said that the largest unexplored surface, well, not surface, but above ground, well, that's not right either, non-ocean area, was the tunnels and subways and abandoned basements and such under New York City. As far as surface area goes, that was just the largest uncharted portion of the Earth.
Well, that's not true, but nice comment. But anyway, I don't want to not talk about spelunkers. There's a tremendous amount of limestone topography. Certainly Yucatan Peninsula is like a giant sponge. Florida is as well. There's a lot of unexplored territory that's not under the ocean, but's under the ground. And that's I'm an equal opportunity explorer. I go there, too.
800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's see if we get a question from the audience here at the Grosvenor Auditorium.
Thank you. I'm Basil Nikas from Washington, D.C. I've had the privilege of traveling around the world and living in places like Egypt for many years, and my background's history. I recently saw a documentary on lost cities that were due to the oceans coming over, and interestingly enough, one was in Japan, another one's in Cuba, another one in India, pretty much on the same parallel. That would be an interesting course of new exploration to find out where these people came from and what happened to them, because they find these cities are all the same monolithic structure, and they're over 10,000 years.
Absolutely. In fact, we were doing a program for National Geographic last year on the Battle of Gallipoli at the entrance to the Dardanelles, and we were looking for a British battleship, the Triumph, the HMF Triumph, that was sunk by a German U-boat in World War I. And as we closed in on the Triumph, off to our right, we saw what looked like Neolithic stone circles. And I'm confident that certainly on the continental shelves of the world, which were above water during the Ice Age, that there are a lot of Neolithic sites all over the planet. So, yeah, another great place to go.
One of the places you've been returning to again and again, though, is the Black Sea.
I think there's a lot of home runs in there. Tune in to when our ship, the Nautilus, enters the Black Sea in June and July will be. I'm still thinking there's some good discoveries there. But we're not going to talk about it till we have a smoking gun.
Well, the reason there may be.
Because in some cases, two scholars from Columbia University, Bill Ryan and Walter Pittman, wrote a book called Noah's Flood, where they postulated that that the Black Sea might have been the site of that legendary story, because we do know that it was flooded suddenly. And we've actually gone down. I think you were with me, Neil, when we found the ancient shoreline about 400 feet beneath the ocean of the Black Sea. And we brought up some of the pebbles from the shore. We brought up some of the mollusks that were living there. We dated them, and we were able to show when that flood took place, which was about 7,500 BP. So, I think there's a lot of stuff down there that used to be above water.
And preserved, because there's no oxygen.
Exactly.
Down.
There's no oxygen. We thought initially no oxygen below 300 feet. We're finding it's even shallower than that. We're finding highly preserved shipwrecks, wood and everything, and someday we'll pull out the cargo and as well as the crew, less than 100 meters under the ocean.
And how old are these ships?
Well, the ones that we found so far are mostly, the oldest was classical. About 600 BC.
We're talking with Robert Ballard, the deep sea explorer who discovered the wreck of the Titanic on a list of other claims to fame. We're at National Geographic today. When we come back, we'll hear from an emerging explorer about what she does and what's still left to explore. And your calls, geologists, physicists, anthropologists, what is left to explore? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Washington headquarters of the National Geographic. And we're talking about explorers. We learn about the famous ones in grade school: Magellan, Columbus, Lewis and Clark. The world has changed a great deal since then. So have explorers. What is left for them to explore? Robert Ballard is our guest, a well-known deep-sea explorer, National Geographic explorer in residence, also founder and chief scientist of the Jason Foundation for Education. We want to hear from scientists and researchers today, geologists, physicists, anthropologists, what's left to explore? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us on stage is Jill Preetz. She's a professor of anthropology at Iowa State University, but spends much of her time in Africa studying chimpanzees on the savannas of Senegal, also a National Geographic emerging explorer, and joins us just off a plane from Tanzania. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're a biological anthropologist, a researcher. What does it mean to be an explorer in your field?
Well, I'm a little biased towards chimpanzees, but I think that chimpanzees are one of the best examples we have of an animal that is very well studied, but yet we're still finding new things about this mammal. And so in my field, we're very directed, so we have specific hypotheses, but yet, you know, as Bob said, we never know what we're going to find. So I had some really interesting questions to me when I started out, but I'd say that most people find my discoveries to be a little more interesting than my scientific hypotheses.
Really? Your discoveries include, as I understand it, the finding that chimpanzees will take down a branch from a tree, sharpen a point with their teeth, and use it to hunt.
Yes. And this year we racked up about 45 hunts this past year when I was there. And so that brings us to a total of about 120 bouts. Now we're at the point where we can look at individual differences. And so females tend to sharpen the tips of the tools with their teeth. The females do the hunting more than males. And when I started out, I was interested in feeding ecology. And definitely this is a part of feeding ecology, but it's nothing I could have ever predicted.
And nobody noticed this before?
Well, there were a couple of instances reported, but the fact is that we really knew very little about savanna chimpanzees. So the chimps I study live in a savanna habitat. And it wasn't until my own project was successful in habituating chimps that we were able to study their behavior. So now they're used to us. We can follow them like they do with studies of forested chimpanzees. But yearly, we come up with new discoveries, I'd say, of behavior, and they really differ.
And how important is it that you come up with something new first?
Well, that's not necessarily the goal when I start out, but it definitely is a bonus. And it is, again, it's something that I wouldn't predict, but yet it keeps happening. And so to me, it's really interesting and I'd say encouraging for young scientists, budding scientists, because like I said, chimps are better studied than any other mammal species. We've studied chimps for over 50 years at a number of sites, but yet my study is, in effect, somewhat like Jane Goodall's studies at Gombe's. At Gombe in the 1960s, it's a natural history study because we do know so very little. And I think that the same can be said for many animal and species throughout the world.
So the best studied mammal on Earth, ourselves aside, well, maybe including ourselves, yet there's still so much to know.
Definitely, definitely.
Let's see if we get some more questions in from callers and from here in the audience at National Geographic.
Hi, my name's Bridget. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm wondering if there's a bit of a cost to our ability to explore the Earth. I'm thinking about Google Maps and satellites and how that might affect, should we be concerned about our privacy?
About our privacy, our personal privacy or the privacy of peoples?
I guess both. The personal privacy, you know, that someone can be looking at your car, your house, yourself on the satellite.
I guess I don't necessarily worry about those things, although even, and I would probably claim that I'm not so technologically sophisticated as some of my colleagues. But I definitely think it's a changing world. I think there's a lot of benefits to it. I can do things at my site that we couldn't do, of course, 10 years ago, definitely that early explorers couldn't do, that people even like Jane Goodall 50 years ago couldn't do. And there is a cost to it. I think that, you know, we have to sort of adapt and be careful. But I can do pretty amazing things. I can, with a modem, I can link. I can, and Bob has done this quite a bit, I can basically allow students access to my work in the field. I can transmit live. Haven't had a lot of success doing this, so maybe I'll ask Bob about this. It's a little difficult, but there are amazing things we can do, but definitely we have to be aware of the cost.
Well, you're also studying animals who are on the edge. They're interacting with people a lot, not just you, the scientist studying them. You've habituated them to your presence, but they're interacting with people a lot. So can you study the animals without studying the people as well?
That's a great question, because I love to have cultural anthropologists help me out in that regard. So I am definitely interested in studying chimpanzees, but one of the things that drew me to the site is they do overlap. They're sympatric, we say, with humans, and you don't always find that in Africa. So chimps aren't hunted because of cultural taboos against eating them, and it makes for an amazing scenario, very complex set of interactions between chimps and people. And I do encourage students, I usually have one or two students a year come out and study aspects of the human groups that live in the area. So I kind of constrain myself to the chimps, and have students come out to study humans.
Let's see if we get another caller question from here in the audience.
That's a great question. That's something I have to deal with always, and something I was well aware of when I started. So like I said, the chimpanzees live alongside people, and I'm an anthropologist. As an anthropologist, I tried to...
And just let me interrupt you. We had some technological glitch. I'm sure people on the radio heard the question.
Sure, okay.
Would you mind repeating it, Stephanie?
Sure. To local ecosystems, species, and the people that live there.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So as I said, the chimpanzees at my site do live alongside humans. I'm an anthropologist, and while I'm a biological anthropologist, interested in the chimpanzees, as an anthropologist, I also tried to be very cognizant of the fact that I'm affecting not only the animals I study, but the people in the area. So we were very formal in our... and the steps we took to establish the research there. I couldn't do my research without not only the permission of the local people and authorities at various levels, but without the help. So I have Senegalese field assistants, Senegalese project managers. They're integral to my study, but we definitely acknowledge that we change things there. I'm even more worried about the chimpanzees that I study because they are on the edge, so to speak, of the geographical range. Even though people don't eat chimps at my site, which is great, of course, they're threatened by population expansion, et cetera. And so I have a very conservative protocol. I have very few people with me in the field. So the chimps are habituated to us, but they're not habituated to strangers. They're okay if we bring someone with us. That person is okay. But I definitely keep that in mind. I, for example, only follow male chimpanzees as targets because females periodically are targeted for their infants for the pet trade. And so I have a number of different really conservative steps to my protocol. And I always keep that in mind. It's something that I pass on to my students. We always have to keep in mind how we affect not only the animals, but the people, as you mentioned, where I work.
Thank you, Stephanie. Appreciate the help out, too. Let's go next to Tyler. Tyler with us from Ashland in Virginia.
Yeah, hi. I used to command a Navy mine countermeasure ship that had a remotely piloted submarine. Is Dr. Ballard still there?
Oh, yes, he's still here.
Okay. Well, what I was going to ask is that when we would operate our remotely piloted submarine, I discovered that by putting amber filters over the otherwise white lights that were used for the camera, that a lot of the fish species couldn't see that amber light, so they wouldn't get in the way of our cameras when we were doing our work. Have you tried anything like that?
Yeah, actually, the problem is it doesn't penetrate as far. But, yeah, we, in fact, have multiple lights at different wavelengths. The best is green. But National Geographic really doesn't like that color.
For their television programs.
But if we really want to see, we turn on our green lights, and we can see much further, but we tend to turn off our cameras at that point.
Tyler,
I wanted to ask you also about the Scientist at Sea program. The Navy has a really good program where they embark scientists from all different backgrounds to come to sea on the ships, and I would like to see that expanded to the point where a lot more independent research is being done from those Navy platforms because they're all over the world and that we might as well get some use out of them.
I think you're talking to a retired commander.
Yeah, well, I spent 30 years in the Navy, and I'm well aware of it. The biggest problem we have is the security issues coming off military platforms because then we're telling people where the platform is, which is not encouraged. Our ship, the Nautilus, we actually have educators embedded in our team who are working 24/7. You go to our website, nautiluslive.org, and we're 24/7 when we're at sea, which will begin again this coming summer. So I'm very much in using platforms to broadcast. It's just whether the platform will let you.
And Tyler, I wonder, given that, can you tell us the most interesting thing you saw from your mine countermeasure ship?
We saw a lot of interesting benthic life, but a lot of that stuff was deemed by the mission to be something in the way rather than something we were actually looking for. But we did volunteer to collect water samples for the fisheries department while we were operating in the Gulf, and we ended up collecting a lot of samples to confirm the transport of what's called G. brevi, or the red tide, and that helped confirm some of the satellite information.
Since you were mine countermeasures, when you say the Gulf, I assume you mean Persian rather than Mexican?
Both.
Oh, really?
Practice in one.
Yeah. The mine countermeasure ships for our Navy, a lot of them are stationed down in the Gulf of Mexico.
Panama City.
Uh-huh. All right. Well,
but the one final thing, I didn't know whether you'd mentioned to the listeners how people could join the crew with Dr. Ballard. I think that's a fascinating project he's got.
Well, we love volunteers that have talent to begin with. We're always looking for free, talented people. But also, we have a website, as I said, where you can literally come aboard the ship through our telepresence technology, which is NautilusLive.org. So bookmark it, and we'll see you in the Black Sea around July.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Tyler, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye now.
You just heard Robert Ballard, a explorer in residence here at the National Geographic. Also with us is Jill Preetz, a biological anthropologist who studies chimpanzees on the African savanna and a National Geographic emerging explorer. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And let's get another question from here in the audience at the Grosvenor Auditorium.
Hi, my name is Zach from Washington, D.C., and I'd love to ask this of both of the panelists. If you had unlimited funding, what top five things would you be exploring?
We'll cut that to two. Jill.
Oh, gosh. Unlimited funding, that's mind-boggling a little bit. I guess one thing I might start at is just a simple assessment of how many chimpanzees are left in Senegal and something we're doing, but it's something very basic, but in many ways that's something we really need to know these days. So as explorers, we're kind of, we have sort of a a different type of conservation problem to deal with, and so in some way we're kind of in a desperate situation. We didn't need to know exactly how many animals are left. That would be my top choice. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Bob?
Well, I would just take the two America ships of exploration, the Okeanos Explorer and the Nautilus, that are funded by NOAA's Office of Ocean Exploration, and I would fund them to go to sea more than they're going to see. We have greater capacity to go to sea than we're allowed to, so if I had more money, I'd get more explorers on the bottom of the ocean.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Doug, and Doug with us from Jamestown in Nevada. Excuse me,
well,
Jamestown, New York.
I'm an old biologist, and one of my questions for these experts, which I wish I could follow them, is that precariously, I think we need to explore every day. And when we have made inroads in various places that I've been saddened by what's happened afterwards, specifically an exploration out of control for various economic reasons. And I think all of the panelists need to safeguard those environments. I'd like to know how they're doing it and if there's some places where we shouldn't go, because I think there are, and I think we need to maintain them.
It's interesting, Jill. I understand one of the national parks that is supposed to be set aside for preservation of things like the chimp, yet there's mining going on there.
Well, there's mining right outside the national park, but that's definitely something. So exploration, a little different bit of type of exploration. That's something that's threatening the chimpanzee population. Personally, I am dedicated to continuing my research as long as I'm able to, but I've also made plans. For example, if something happened to me in the field, I have students that I work with and I've continued to work with, and I try to encourage them to develop their own research sites, et cetera, and we're really committed to a long-term project, not something that we would abandon and move on and just leave. But there are definitely changes today, and so it's crucial that we explore these areas in Senegal where mining is going to affect chimpanzees, for example. But it definitely, we have, I think, we're a strong sense of responsibility in terms of what the effect is of our exploration and what needs to be done, what commitment we have to make.
Bob Ballard, are there places we shouldn't go?
No. I think we just have to be careful. I think for example, when we work off Turkey, we're under what are called imaging permits. We're not allowed to even touch the bottom. And so the beauty of our technology is we do not touch the bottom. We're able with our robots, unlike our submersibles that are big clunkers, we literally can hover and not do any damage. I think that was the question, damage done by explorers. And you definitely can do damage, but I think you don't not do damage by not exploring. You just do non-intrusive exploration. And the technology we have today is elegant. I mean, I can literally be hovering over something a few inches away and get up and go to the bathroom and ask my vehicle not to move and come back, and it's still waiting for me. And so the technology we have is quite mind-boggling. So there's no reason why you need to be intrusive.
Doug, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. More with Robert Ballard and Jill Preetz in a moment about the role of explorers in 2011 and the future, what's left to explore on this planet, and your calls. Geologists, physicists, anthropologists, call and tell us what's left to explore. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And we're also going to be joined by Michael Nick Nichols, a wildlife photographer who's got great experience, particularly on Michael Fay's 2,000-mile mega transect expedition from the Congo to Gabon back at the turn of the century. This is NPR News. Right now, in partnership with National Geographic, we're broadcasting from their Washington headquarters, and we're exploring the world of explorers, what they do in the 21st century, what's left to explore. We want to hear from scientists and researchers today. 800-989-8255, email talk at npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are deep-sea explorer Robert Ballard, a National Geographic explorer in residence, director of the Institute of Archaeological Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island, and a National Geographic emerging explorer, Jill Preetz, a biological anthropologist who studies chimpanzees on the African savanna. She also works as an associate professor of anthropology at Iowa State University. And let's see if we can get another voice in on the conversation. Also on stage with us here at National Geographic, Michael Nick Nichols, a wildlife photographer who's traveled to some of the world's most remote places. He's National Geographic Editor-at-Large for Photography. He documented the conservationist Michael Fay's 2,000-mile mega transect expedition from Congo to Gabon. And Nick, nice to have you with
us today. Thanks.
On Talk of the Nation. What is it that you do that you consider exploration? How is your work different than, for example, a primatologist?
Well, we didn't define what exploration was. You know, for me, it's always been just going into the unknown, and I've been doing it since I was a kid with caves. So when Mike started that long walk, he didn't know where it was going. So anything you do that you don't know where you're going, I think, is exploration.
So this would qualify me for much of my life. Yes.
No, and you know, so once Mount Everest has been climbed once, you know, after that maybe it's adventure. There's a difference. And so what do I do that's exploration? My next project is lions, and we know lions is an animal that hunts in the savannah and does these things, but we never actually have been on their terms. They actually hunt by the dark night, not by full moon, not by daylight, and the dark night, we can't see a thing. So technology is advanced enough just today with night vision and thermal and digital photography that maybe, if I'm lucky, in the next 2 years, I can show you lions as they really are.
In the next 2 years, if you're lucky.
If I'm lucky.
This is lucky.
Perseverance.
So you need, in addition to luck and skill and being in the right place at the right time, you need somebody back here in Washington who's extremely patient.
And we didn't talk about it. We need money, too. You have to. And the money for media is different than it used to be. So philanthropy starts to play. But if you look at exploration over the ages, that was always the issue. How do you get funded? So you have to be a P.T. Barnum sometimes. You have to get on the soapbox and sing and get your money. But so if 2 years runs out, I'm not coming back. I'll just stay until I get some more money. Because I'm afraid. I want to show you this. I desperately want to. Because the things that I photograph are, in 30 years, they're all disappearing. Everything that I photograph is going. So, you know, I'm very frightful. And I think if we show people these chimpanzees, for instance, that maybe they can survive. If we show them these places that Bob finds, maybe they don't disappear. I just can't deal with that, things disappearing in my little blip on the planet.
Are things that you saw on that long walk
absolutely
gone now?
You know, the mega transect, the reason it happened is there was a war in Congo.
That still is.
And the Brazzaville Congo.
Yeah, oh, no, the
not,
other one.
Not the, yeah. So the researchers couldn't get home. So they started flying from the northern Congo over to Libreville over 4.5 hours of forest because they couldn't go out the traditional way. And Mike, who's a botanist, not an he's not an animal scientist, he could see, now, there's nothing down there. But all those trees did show him that where there had been human plantations in the long past. And he said, geez, there's a section of forest 2,000 miles long that hasn't been exploited, and the animals in there may have never been hunted, they may not have been influenced, but wait, if we go there and look, we can tell the world what to protect before it's too late. Generally, we make national parks after it's too late. We don't make them in time. So in this case, we made 13 national parks before the logging had happened. But now, okay, that was 10 years ago, every single one of those parks is completely surrounded by logging. And the pygmies, who were so important to that project that I photographed doing things culturally that were really interesting, all of that's gone. Gone.
Interesting question we have from email from David in Berkeley. Several years ago, a story came out about a tribe in Brazil that had never contacted modern civilization. Turned out to be something of a hoax. But my question is, how many societies are there around the world that have no contact with modern civilization? What will happen to them in this century?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that that's true. It's kind of hard for me to believe that there could be any terrestrial people that haven't been contacted. But every now and then in Brazil, one pops up. Brazil is it. That's the, you know, the lost city of Z, that kind of fantasy. But the pygmies had all long had contact.
Yeah.
So this fantasy, there is a bit of a fantasy that if it hasn't been discovered, you should leave it alone to protect it. And that's if you leave it alone, it's gone. But I don't think there, I really don't, but I hope that somebody will say, oh, there's another tribe in Brazil. But as soon as you find them, they're going to get our diseases and die. It's just a no win.
Got a question here from the microphone in the Grosvenor Auditorium.
I was wondering if any of you see a role for citizen science in future exploration of the Earth?
Citizen science? What do you mean by that?
Having regular non-trained citizens, you know, people who aren't scientists, going out and documenting things. This summer, I took part in a study done in the Rocky River in Cleveland, Ohio, to document existence of and diversity of macroinvertebrates in the water system to give an idea of water quality. And a lot of that was done by other TAs, including myself from the Cleveland State Geology Department, but also families and people who were just interested in going out and exploring where they live. Mm-hmm. And we got hundreds of thousands of pieces of data from it because people were willing to go out and spend their own time and document what they found. And it was great for the Cleveland Metro Park system, but something not normally followed.
I wonder, Bob Ballard?
Well, we're actually launched a new paradigm where normally scientists go on the field, they gather their data, and it's theirs. And they sit on it, and sometimes they die before they even do anything about it. All of our data is streamed in real time. So when we're out with the Nautilus, every sensor, every image, everything that we're doing is streamed live. Now, it's taking a while for the scientific community to believe it. Because they say, why would you do that? Why would you raise all this money, mount an expedition, and then dump the data? Well, that's the whole point. As many minds as you can get into the game. And so I think in the information era, when you look at how much information is being collected, it's silly to sit on data. There's so much of it. We collected 30 terabytes of data. And so we welcome people to look at our data. And so please do. It's available. It's not proprietary. It's in real time. And hope you see something I didn't see.
Nick Nichols, is there a role?
I totally believe in citizen science. So what I was talking about earlier is that yes, we can all explore. And if you have your little creek bed where you live, and you find out new stuff that helps us conserve it, and a lot of that collection has to be done by all of us in my little valley and outside of Charlottesville. We want to explore that stream and know what all the frogs and the salamanders are doing. The only way to do it is with citizen science.
Jill, isn't this a little trickier if you're dealing with animals?
It can be tricky. You know, as Nick pointed out, we can transmit diseases to people who haven't had contact with others, and definitely the same for great apes. It's one of the reasons I have a small group. But I've had people come out and help me out with various parts of my project, maybe not as exciting as they'd like. They can help with cataloging plants, for example, but I think that is a great way for us to benefit as well as people who are interested in science and maybe haven't had the same opportunities that I've had or we've had or maybe decide later in life they want to embark in some sort of experience like this. I think it's a great opportunity, and I think that it does occur in various disciplines.
Yeah, you know, when you look at our ship, for example, there's 42 people on the ship. you were out on a ship like our exploration ship, there's only four, quote, scientists aboard that ship. So the vast majority of the people on the ship are not scientists. In fact, the people that have the, quite honestly, have the most bottom time are our pilots, not our scientists. And commonly, a pilot will say, I've never seen that before. And you quickly turn your head when a pilot says, I haven't seen that before, because they have more bottom time than we do. And so
pilots are
driving the
ROVs,
vehicles. Yeah. And quite honestly, now that we're streaming it, if you want to watch us 24/7 and send in your comments, push a little button and it says send your comment. If you see something we don't see, or you've had the tenacity to stay up longer than I have, people ask me what we did on our last expedition. We were at sea for 4.5 months, 24 hours a day. I don't yet know what I did. I'm just read a publication coming down that we're publishing where all of us got together and said what we learned, and I'm finally finding out what we did. So all the room in the world for citizen scientists to get in the game.
I was on one expedition with Bob Ballard when he managed to conquer every level of doom, as I recall. So, lots of extra time on some of those voyages. We're talking with Bob Ballard, a National Geographic Explorer in Residence, Jill Preetz, who's a biological anthropologist and a National Geographic Emerging Explorer, and Nick Nichols, who's a National Geographic Editor-at-Large for Photography. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Michelle on the line. Michelle's calling us from Fairbanks.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hello, Dr. Ballard. I'm thrilled that you're raising these issues regarding the fact that there remains so much to be explored. Speaking from my perspective as an Alaskan marine ecologist, I just wanted to mention that I think one of our greatest opportunities is to explore the area that is now relatively ice-free, the exposed deep portions of the Arctic, as well as other areas. I've been looking at deep-sea food webs in canyons, areas where the deadliest catch fisheries occur. There are some deep-sea canyons that seem to be supporting those fisheries, so we're trying to understand those food webs, as well as places like the Aleutian Trench. But we're certainly challenged in the north by lack of dedicated resources for doing this kind of work. And my question is, how can we try to obtain more dedicated deep sea technology for the Alaskan region, the Arctic, as we continue to build our research programs up here?
Dr. Ballard?
Well, the assets are there. Our ships, for example, we don't determine where they go. It's determined by the entire community. And so it's really a participatory program, and certainly with the warming of the planet, the Northwest Passage is going to finally be open. So I expect, quite honestly, more exploration to take place in the higher latitudes than ever before.
It's interesting. Michelle, can you tell us what you're finding in some of those places where ice covered the ocean for so long, and now you do have access?
We do have access. The area I've been working mostly are two of the largest undersea canyons in the world, the largest, Zemchug Canyon, which is partially ice-covered seasonally. That's been fully exposed in the summers for quite some time. And in that region, there are still tremendous coral colonies and tremendous rockfish assemblages. In some areas, it's been a heavily fished region, both by the Russians and us, for quite a while, very productive. But the benthic communities that we've been able to access using, inspired by Sylvia Earle's early work, we've been using deep workers, hope to get deep rover up here, as well as ROVs, and we're finding a tremendously viable benthic communities in patches.
Benthic meaning deep sea.
We haven't yet gotten to the Arctic, though. And that's where we're hoping to go next, is Barrow Canyon in the Arctic.
Meaning bottom, yes. Going to the Arctic, Bob Ballard, that would mean getting under the ice. That's not easy.
Well, actually, more and more it's easier with the new autonomous vehicles now. I'd love to go after Shackleton.
Autonomous vehicles.
We presently use what are called remotely operated vehicles, which are on tethers. But there's now a whole big expansion of vehicle technology where they're basically pre-programmed robots that go out and do their own thing as sort of hunt dogs and come back and tell you what they found. So AUVs are sort of like underwater cruise missiles kind of technology, very pervasive now, and it gives you an opportunity when you're out at sea, for example, and you've got your vehicles down, that no matter how big your ship is, two cables in the water is a knot. And so not a knot of speed, but a knot of two cables wrapped around one another. So you can't put a lot of cabled vehicles in the water from one platform, but you can put out an endless number of AUVs. So we see them as sort of hunt dogs that we can send out all around the ship, and as my military term, force multipliers. And they can all of a sudden cover a lot more real estate and go under the ice where you can't go yourself.
Nick, when do you head out back to the Savannah?
I'm going to photograph another tree. I did a pretty famous picture a couple of years ago of a redwood tree. It's very tall, and we built it by compositing pictures together. And I'm going to photograph maybe the largest tree on Earth in a snowstorm. But it's not the tree that's known as the largest tree on Earth. So if we get lucky, we'll have a surprise. But the idea is just to make a really beautiful photograph of a giant sequoia in a snowstorm. I'm doing that in February.
Well, good luck with that. Joe Preet, you're back here for a while? And
I am back here. They like me to teach every once in a while, so I'm back here for the spring semester and then out to Senegal in May again.
Well, thank you all very much for your time today and for telling us a little bit about what explorers do now in the 21st century. Before we leave today, we need to say thank you to everybody here at National Geographic and to our technical crew at the Grosvenor Auditorium and back in Studio 3A for the hospitality and help with our show today. Tomorrow, Talk of the Nation Science Friday, Ira Flato will be here with a look at the anti-vaccine movement with Paul Offit, plus how to make the most of your television. We'll see you again on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.